Senate will come to order. Messages from the House.
February the 16th, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bill listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 81, Omnibus Water Bill Construction. Ayes 58, excused 2. Senate File 103, Gillette Madison Water Project Financing. Ayes 53, noes 5, excused 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 16th, 2011, from the House of Representatives. Message number 334, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 94, Liability for Emergency Equipment Donations. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excused 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. February the 16th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message 336, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 9, Department of Insurance Licensures Revisions. Ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill 62, Wyoming Controlled Substance Act Amendments. Ayes 57, noes 1, excused 2. House Bill 95, Involuntary Commitment Examiners. Ayes 55, noes 3, excused 2. And House Bill 105, Temporary Military Duty, Child Custody and Visitation. Ayes 58, excused 2. February the 16th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 339, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill 124, National Guard Emergency Deployment Professional Licensing. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes no, ayes zero, noes 58, excused 2. The House requests the Senate appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
We have a concurrence or a non-concurrence here. House failed to concur on House Bill 124, the National Guard Emergency Develop Professional Licensing. I'd like Senator Schiffer, Chairman, Case, and Landon to be the Joint Conference Committee on House Bill 124. Senator Case?
Would it be permissible to announce a conference committee meeting this afternoon?
I'm sorry?
Would it be possible to announce?
Yes. Go ahead, Senator Case. This would be a proper, appropriate time.
Mr. President, I'd like to announce the conference committee on mail ballot elections. And I believe that Scott and Hastert and myself will be meeting with a like committee from the House upon adjournment today.
Thank you, Senator Case. Senator Perkins? Just a minute. Senator Perkins, so I get you turned. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. I would announce the Conference Committee for Message 286 on Senate File 15, Court Jurisdiction. That will be tomorrow on adjournment.
Thank you. Are there any other announcements pertaining to conference committees? That's okay, Senator. Go ahead. We'll take care of this now, and then we'll get on to other things. Go ahead, Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President. Privilege of the floor for just a quick moment.
Yes, go ahead.
This morning I introduced some community health professionals, and unfortunately didn't have a fourth name. Would like to let you know that was Lynn Wydell from Cheyenne, who was also here this morning. So if you see her out in the hallways or whatever, I hope you'll make sure she had a good day. And thank you, Mr. President.
Okay, and Senator Bebout, did you have something?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. Yes, Mr. President, your Joint Conference Committee will meet up in S18 tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock for Senate File 109 and Senate File 113.
Okay, thank you for that announcement. Any other announcements before we go on to our next message? Senator Geis, go ahead.
Get them out of the way.
Just as well.
Joint Conference Committee on House Bill 18 will be tomorrow morning up in S15, quarantine of animals.
Okay.
Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in S15.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, are you ready in regard to message number 334?
I am, Mr. President.
Reading clerk will read that message in at this time, please.
February the 16th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, message number 334, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 94, liability for emergency equipment donation. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excuse 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Go ahead, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move message number 334, which concerns Senate File 94, and ask that you vote aye. They did some very simple changes down there, Mr. Chairman. If you want to look on page 5 and 6, they put a period after the word donors and then said deleted that resulting injury to the recipients of the equipment. That was repetitive. It wasn't needed. And the rest of their amendments down there made it effective immediately and instead of July 1. And I think that's just fine. Let's get the equipment donated. So I would ask that you vote aye.
The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 94. You've been asked to vote aye. Chief Clerk will call the roll, please.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Amrick?
Aye.
Esquivel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Schiffer, Scott,
aye.
Von Slatern,
aye.
President Anderson.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 29 ayes, 1 no.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 94.
I have a bill.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 16th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 155, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, and Rothfuss, Senator Coe, Chairman. February the 16th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 182, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, and Rothfuss, Senator Coe, Chairman. February the 16th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 49, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that order of business for consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion's carried. Senator Bernard, you have the chair.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 37. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 37, State Archives Storage Study, an act relating to state archives, sponsored by the Travel Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 37. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that be read in.
Yes, will the clerk read the amendment?
House Bill 37, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2 after line 6.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the Standing Committee Amendment will be explained by the Chairman of the Joint Appropriations Committee, but as to the explanation of the bill itself, I ask that you call on the tall senator from Devil's Tower.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 37 and encourage its adoption, and I would refer to. Thank you. Explain the bill. This bill is a bill relating to the state archives. We've got all kinds of documentation coming in at this point in time into the state archives. Some of it's digital, some of it's paper. Otherwise, we're rapidly hitting the point that we're going to have to come up with some type of system to hit one type of media to do it on. This is a general appropriation for $200,000 to contract with a firm to find which means is the best and what's the most cost-effective means for doing so. I would ask for a favorable recommendation.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I move the Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 37. Folks, the issue here is that archives within the State Parks and Cultural Resources is sort of the recipient of all these documents, electronic emails, and they're sort of the, I hate to say it, but they're the dumping site of all this, and so they continue to come to us periodically and say we need more space. And our question is, well, what are you storing, how long are you storing it, and how is it being delivered to you? And if you're getting a paper set of it and you're getting a microfiche set of it, why are you having two, and do you even know what you have and what's in duplication? Well, they're the sort of the tail on the dog, and what we're doing through this amendment is requiring that the cultural resources folks get together with the CIO and require the participation of all agencies throughout state government to join together and reevaluate, create standards for preservation of documents, both paper, microfiche, and electronic. And let's see if we can't get a coordinated effort, then require the CIO to update the rules and regulations with respect to electronic records and let's see if we can't get a control on the massive amount of storage that we're doing. So effectively what we did is we brought three groups together, and A&I, Cultural Resources, and the CIO, and said, let's come up with a statewide plan. And that's all we've done here. I urge your support.
Senator Schiffer?
With regards to the bringing the three agencies together, and I think I'm on the amendment, but if I'm not, I'll stray. I don't see any timeline in here. Whenever we're talking three different agencies, if they don't have a timeline, it may not get done in our lifetime. And I just wondered whether there was any discussion about making sure this moved forward and that they actually did talk to each other before the next millennium.
Senator Driscoll.
Good. The timeline's in the bill ahead of it. I'm trying to. Sorry, I'm not. What's that? Line 12? Page 1, yeah. Period beginning, line 11 and 12, period beginning with effective date of this act and ending June 30, 2012.
Just so you know, we are on the amendment, Senator Nicholas.
Okay.
That was funny. Mr. Chairman, you're right. We didn't set a timeline. You know, I look back through this. What we may want to do is, as we're moving this through, put in a reporting date to bring a report back to both the standing committee that proposed the bill as well as the JAC. Frankly, it was my assumption that we would have a report by the time we are working on the budget next year, because this is of great concern to us. It's a very expensive process. And another reason I'm not too worried about it is because they need more space, and we probably won't give them more space until they come up with a plan.
Senator Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I just hope that these three agencies, and I know the State Archivist will emphasize these standards from the National Archives, they're proven.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 37, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. That amendment is passed. We are on the bill.
Question.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 37, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. House Bill 37 has passed committee of the whole. Our next bill for consideration will be House Bill 63. The reading clerk will read that in.
House Bill 63, Subdivisions Water Study, an act relating to subdivisions, sponsored by Representative Madden. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivisions. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
The reading clerk has read the bill. Senator Case. Nope. Ness.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 63, Subdivisions Water Study. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Okay.
House Bill 63.
The clerk will read the amendment.
House Bill 63, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 20.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 63. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd kind of like to talk to them both together, if you don't mind. Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that refines some work that we did last year with respect to subdivisions and the requirements. We've had lots of bills to help people to understand what they're getting into with respect to a subdivision and to make sure that it's clear that they don't have roads and there's issues with water. And this is a water study. This is about the water study that has to be filed with respect to a subdivision plan. And right now, Mr. Chairman, there's just enough gap in how this thing is interpreted that it's been a source of considerable litigation, especially in the area of my co-sponsor over in the other body. So what the bill does is you'll see it goes into where the study is filed, and on page 2, it adds that a study evaluating the water supply system proposed for the subdivision and the adequacy and safety of the system, the study results shall at a minimum include the following. So it's saying it clears up that you have to actually report this stuff, and it goes down, it lists the things that the study result has to say about the conflict with wells and all the things that we put in last year. But some of the source of confusion and potential litigation has been, for example, on page 2, Romanet 3, where it says the list of all surfaces and groundwater rights which will be used or which may be affected, including state engineer application and permit numbers, description, and expected effects. Well, that's kind of broad, Mr. Chairman, and that's why the bill's broad. It kind of tries to narrow it down and change the word may be affected, which is broad and indeterminate, to will be affected. And the subject of the standing committee amendment was to change the will to will likely be affected. So we're taking it from may to will likely. Now, if you can think, if you're going to argue about a subdivision water study and you have the word May is a very broad concept. I mean, is that 100 years from now, May, or what is it? Will likely gets it more to the fact, will the proposed development impact the water supplies? Will they likely impact the water supplies on a more basis that's relevant to engineering and hydrology? So that is pretty much the essence of the bill. You can see that the expected effects have to be identified by the study. You can go over to page 3, and you have the mitigation, again, has to come from events which will likely result now, Mr. Chairman, from the use of water within the proposed subdivision, as identified by the study, unless such conflicts are deemed not to exist to the satisfaction of the board. Mr. Chairman, we have the same language on line 14, which is a list of all surface and groundwater rights which will be used or which will likely be affected, and identified by the study. And then Romanet 5 on the bottom of page 3 wraps this up, and it says plans for the mitigation of water right conflicts resulting from the use of water is now changed to conflicts which will likely result from the use of water. That's the gist of the entire bill, and that's the standing committee. Be happy to discuss the amendment. If there's no questions, call for the question on the amendment, then the bill.
You've heard...
Question on amendment.
Okay, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 63, please say aye.
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 Further discussion?
Question.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 63, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Bill 63 has passed Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 69. Reading clerk will read in the bill.
House House Bill 69, Prescription for Marijuana Invalid, an act relating to controlled substances, sponsored by Representative Buchanan. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll, and Escobel, Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Give the whole rise report, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 69, Prescriptions for Marijuana Invalid. There are no standing committee amendments, and to give a further explanation of the bill, rather an intoxicating explanation, I ask that you call on the majority floor leader.
Senator Ross.
Chairman, members of the Senate will bring to you House Bill 69, Prescriptions for Marijuana Invalid. What this bill does is the language on page 2 of this bill goes in and basically states that it's not okay to prescribe marijuana, period, or its derivatives, except for there is an exception for dronabinol. Now, dronabinol is an oral capsule that's used to treat nausea and vomiting for cancer treatment patients. And so we make an exception for them because they don't generally respond well to other meds. Folks, for those of you that live in southeast Wyoming, you're probably very much aware of the problems that have occurred in Colorado with regards to the prescriptions for marijuana and the rampant uptake of use of marijuana in Colorado and their problems in trying to regulate or even control the distribution of marijuana in Colorado. What this bill basically says is that it's invalid to prescribe, as a practitioner, to prescribe marijuana except for dronabinol. Now, what are the penalties? The penalties for the first two offenses are misdemeanors, up to 12 months and $1,000. However, on a third offense, it goes to 5 years and a felony, and fourth and subsequent offenses. This is a policy question for the Senate and for this legislature as to how we stand in the state of Wyoming with regard to the prescription of marijuana, and I'd urge a favorable consideration of this bill.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 69, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That bill has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 74. The clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 74, Validity of Marriage, an act relating to marriage, sponsored by Representative Peterson. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Geis, and Hicks. No, Senator Emmerich, Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the bill. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Geis.
On the Committee of the Whole Riding Report, I move House Bill 74 do pass, and I'll walk you through the bill real quick. We go down on line 10 under Section 1. And line 11, new paragraph 4 and 5, and by creating a new subsection H, is amended to read, under Wyoming Statute 20-111, out-of-state marriages, up on page 2A, all marriage contracts are valid, and under the authority of foreign nations, which contract are valid in the state, provided that such marriage contract between a male and a female. And then line 7 is B, all marriage contracts which are valid under the authority of the state of Commonwealth territory, districts, or possession of the United States are valid in the state provided that such marriage contracts are between a male and a female. Then we go on down to Line 13, under Wyoming Statute 20-2101, voidable marriages, defined annulments. Line 16A, marriage contracts in Wyoming are void without any degree of divorce. Line 19, little 4, when the parties are not a male and female person, or line 22V, 5, when there are more than two parties in the contract. On page 3, under H, a party to a domestic civil union or marriage would be void under subsection A of this section if contract as marriage in Wyoming shall not be entitled to legal obligations, responsibilities, protection, or benefits afforded or recognized by the law of Wyoming to married people and spouses, whether they derive from statute, administration, rules, policies, common law, or any other source of civil or criminal law. This is effective upon completion. That's all I'm going to tell you about the bill. You vote your conscience, vote it up or down. That's it.
Any further discussion, Senator Case?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pretty big step. It's a gigantic step. This is not changing our law to allow for the union of same-sex couples, but what it's saying is if you were married or in a civil union anywhere in the United States or anywhere in the world, frankly, and you come to Wyoming, we're not going to recognize that that marriage existed. And that's going to mean that for a million different things, like a person that dies without a will, like the transfer of property, like insurance benefits, like any other things that the courts can grant to a citizen in the state of marriage, will be denied. That's the first time I think we've ever kind of done this in Wyoming. We're actually going to say you have made a commitment to each other. You've had this solemn contract. It's recognized by the laws of an appropriate jurisdiction. And you come to Wyoming and it didn't happen. And if you're in a hospital and you're dying and your partner's with you, we're going to have to call your mother because that's the nearest relative that we're going to recognize under Wyoming to make decisions about your life. And maybe, you know, gay people don't have it easy in this world. And chances are their family never recognized that union to begin with or didn't condone it. And now they're all drugged back into it. And you know, somebody that's had a commitment. I have friends that are gay, and you have friends that are gay. And there are people in this room that are probably gay. And if you look up in those pictures all the way around this building and all the way throughout the Capitol, you see gay and lesbian people. They served you coffee this morning. Maybe they fixed your hair. Maybe they had decorated your house. Those are the stereotypical things you talk about. But you know what? They're soldiers. They serve with distinction in the United States military. And that, you know, with the revisions in that policy, don't ask, don't tell is dead. They serve openly, and they're proud of it. They've been in this room. They've stood in front there and talked about their service in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we've stood and applaud them. And now you're going to deny them the benefits if they happen to be married or civil unionized in another state and come here. Our Constitution doesn't permit this. This thing's right on this time. We tried to change it. We passed Senate Joint Resolution 5 out of here. That's what would make this bill constitutional. Senate Joint Resolution 5 is left, and it remains to be completed by the legislature. It remains to be voted on by the people. But that's the only way that you're going to make this bill fit our Constitution. Because without that vote of the people, you right now have to vote on this in light of Article 1, Section 3, that says, since equality and the enjoyment of natural and civil rights is only made sure through political equality, the laws of this state affecting the political rights and privileges of its citizens shall be without distinction of race, color, sex, or any circumstance or condition whatsoever. It doesn't say except for a marriage or civil union from another state. It doesn't say that. When you go home after this vote, you're going to look people in the eye. Your doctor, your lawyers, your friends, your neighbors, and you're going to tell them that you made them into second-class citizens by this vote today if you pass this. You can't do that. We are the equality state. This Senate, well, the people of Wyoming are better than that. They are better than House Bill 74. They're so much better than that. And you know what? You are too.
Further discussion, Senator Von Flatron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Everybody knows my stance on this subject. I don't need to reiterate my argument against this. I ask you to vote no. This isn't a discussion about putting it in front of the people. This is a discussion about us voting this now, putting it in statute, and then whatever becomes of that, either in the courts or not. So I beseech you, please, vote no.
Senator Burns.
In the rush to try and avoid gay marriage, this bill may be cutting a larger swath than that. And I was wondering if one of the proponents of the bill could stand up and explain to me that if somebody comes from, let's say, an Arab country and comes to Wyoming because we're both energy producing states, and they happen to, by their custom, have three wives, and they bring their three wives with them. And let's say one of them gets into an accident. Let's say wife number three gets into an accident. Are we, as a state, not going to recognize his right to make decisions, medical decisions for her, because he has two other wives already? How do we address that if this bill passes? What instructions do we give to that hospital? Because the way I read this, his marriage to his wives, which may have taken place over the last 30 years, would not be valid.
Further discussion? Senator Hazard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You know, this doesn't feel like anything more than kind of a modern-day witch hunt in a way. Unfortunately, our country is full of examples of intolerance. We have examples of intolerance for people of race, culture, and religion throughout this country. There's people in this room that have been on that side of intolerance with other people for their religious views or for their cultural views. We have a group of people that have been labeled, and people still can't seem to come to terms with those labels. And they're polarized in the debate, and people that get hidden have some hidden agendas for, you know, with the intolerance. This is the equality state. Equality means a state of being equal for all. I know most of you have made up your mind on this already. But the fact is that don't let the type of intolerance that we've seen around this country for decades, for centuries, come into Wyoming today. I ask you not to support this.
Quit. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to take the Senate down a little walk down memory lane a little bit, and I hope each of you will think back to the day when each of you chose your own personal sexual preference. Think back to that day. Maybe all the kids in fifth grade were called down to the gymnasium, and maybe there were little booths set up where they were distributing literature and discussing and giving the various options and costs and benefits You know, maybe that happened, but I got to tell you, it didn't happen to me. You know, I'll let you in on a little secret about my life. I personally like females. I'm attracted to females, my wife in particular. And, which is good, which is very good. That's a very good thing. But I didn't make that choice, senators. I never woke up one day or had a moment where I thought to myself, I think I'm going to choose girls. I've given a lot of consideration. I've explored the options. I've thought it through. I choose girls. I don't think anyone in this room made that choice. And the reason I don't think that is because I have a lot of gay friends, and they assure me that they, too, did not wake up one day and make that choice. Now, a lot of people, and some of the people who are looking down right now, are trying to promote the concept that this is a life choice, that this is the kind of thing that you can wake up tomorrow and say, I'm choosing to be heterosexual today. I've had enough of being gay, and let's go the other way for a day. They want you to believe that because it is so hard. It is so difficult, Mr. Chairman, to wake up and hate somebody based on a choice they didn't make. Based on a choice that is as difficult to change as their skin color, or their ethnicity, or their eye color, or their hair color. Hair color, that's not so hard to change. All right, let's take that one back. But the rest of them are very difficult. And if you have to be discriminating, if you have to be taking away someone's rights and equality based on a choice they never made, then clearly that is a violation of our constitutional rights. So it's hard to believe that. It's hard to accept that. But that's the reality. And if each of you were to go around and make some gay friends and sit down with them and ask them, you know, tell me about it. Tell me about your life. Tell me about these choices you've made. I think each of you, too, would come to the same conclusion that this is not a life choice. This is the way people are. And if you, senators like me, did not make this choice and did not wake up today and decide heterosexual again today, then I would urge each of you, like me, to oppose this lousy bill. This lousy bill that basically tries to make a statutory inequality, not just in the state of Wyoming, but to make sure that we're spreading the equality nationwide so that anyone from any state who comes here is treated just as unequally as the gays in our own state. That's not what we want to stand for. That is certainly not consistent, senators, with the equality state message. Please, senators, vote down this lousy bill. I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I tend to focus on language and try to figure out what we're going to do before we decide whether we're going to vote on it. And I guess it's easy enough to understand page 1, 2. Now, when we turn over to page 3, we embark on some new concepts that we need to talk about and try to figure out what it is. But it says a party to a domestic civil union or marriage which would be void under subsection A. Now, incidentally, that would include marriages. Traditionally, the void marriages were those underage or contracts, which we say is a matter of public law or policy, are adhesion-type contracts. So we're not going to recognize it to protect somebody that was in the relationship that was underage or incompetent. And certainly when that, if you are a person that you find yourself as an underage person in a marriage, then you need to go to the court and have a remedy applied to unravel the court. So if we're going to say you have a void relationship, that you're entitled to no protections, and you can't even get into the court, what are you going to do for that minor that finds himself in there? So what are we trying to do? But fundamentally, you always have to say, what is the evil that we're trying to prevent? Now, it's fair enough to say we're only going to recognize a marriage between a man and a woman. That's, when we use the word marriage, we mean a relationship between a man and a woman. There are civil unions out there, and if you want to be definitional, fair enough, do that. My question is on lines 3 and 4 on page 3, these relationships, whatever they are, if they're void, shall not be entitled to the legal obligations, responsibilities, protections, or benefits of a married person. And I guess the challenge is for folks that support the bill or people who understand that language to tell us, what does it mean? Let's take, for example, the discussion with a foreign person, three wives, shows up in Wyoming. So they're married. They're legally married. We don't have to call it a marriage. We just say it is what it is. Does it mean that that person who has an obligation to support three persons within the family can cast out two and say, now that I'm in Wyoming, I have no responsibilities? Now, our courts won't do that. Our courts are open to everybody. There's a dispute there. It has to be resolved. We don't want the wives to run out and get guns and shoot their husbands, or not husbands, whatever you want to call them. They need to have a remedy in court to unravel whatever that relationship is. It's got to be done. There are lots of benefits, and frankly, the benefits and burdens of being married. I'm not sure which of the benefits that I enjoy with my wife that other people can't enjoy, other than being called a marriage. And about the only one that I can come up with is there is an ownership and property that's a tenancy by the entireties. You've all done it on your deeds, joint tenants with right of survivorship. So if you're not a married couple, then you would have to say we're going to be tenants in common with a right of survivorship. But that joint tenancy is a unique relationship and property that allows you to, it's actually a benefit and burden. Your wife enjoys that. You can't get rid of the property and leave your wife destitute without getting her signature. So there are a couple rights, and there are protections to wives under the probate code. So that if you disinherit your wife by giving all your money to somebody else, there's a forced share. So I can think of about 3 or 4 areas where you say, okay, you don't get those benefits. And that makes sense. But there are a lot of benefits and burdens that husbands and wives have, that partners have in a corporation, that you can essentially create by contract. So as we're moving forward, I mean, if we're going to move this bill forward, let's begin to identify what they are. What are those relationships that are unique that shouldn't be shared by others? And I guess the first challenge is, what are we talking about?
Senator Escobel.
Speaking against this bill, page 1 from line 1 to line 6, it says, it's got the word void 3 different times. And as I thought about this, I guess the question I have is, whenever we pass legislation, it usually benefits some entity or organization or something like that. We pass some finances for a certain city, it benefits that city. And as I looked at this, my question is, who does this benefit? What are the benefits? If that question can be answered, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Briefly to answer some of the questions, if we go into page 3, line 3, it says, of this section, if contracted as a marriage. And really, folks, all we're talking about is the definition of marriage here. There's, I think, a lot of misdirection about what this bill and what this bill does and what it doesn't do. We're really talking just about the definition of marriage, the same definition that we've had in our statutes for, since before we were a state. And that is really the whole question of the bill, is the definition of marriage and what we will recognize as a marriage within Wyoming. All the benefits and obligations and responsibilities and protections that are afforded marriage can be afforded to another relationship, primarily through different contractual relationships. That's the testimony that we had in the House when I presented SJ-5. An attorney for the gay and lesbian community from Laramie essentially stated that on the record, that all of these things that are a benefit to marriages, you can go in. It's a cumbersome process, but there is a process in which you can develop that contract and develop relief or definitions of what the benefits, responsibilities, and obligations are in that relationship. Now, we don't have a civil union statute in Wyoming. And if you want to look at the process of developing civil union statute, that should be a separate bill at a separate time. And we should discuss all those. We should look at the different property rights, the different obligations and benefits. If it's the body's direction at some point in time to make that a single signature process and an oath, then that's the body's choice at a separate time. Today we're just talking about the definition of marriage as it is in Wyoming and how that applies when someone else from a different jurisdiction has a different definition of marriage than we do. And so that's basically what this bill does. If you want to talk about all the other things that gays and lesbians don't have as far as the benefits and obligations and responsibilities, that's a civil contract law. That's a civil union bill at a different date. But again, I'll reiterate from the testimony that we heard on SJ-5 that practically everything as far as visiting the hospital, as far as where your assets might go upon a untimely death, all those different things can be negotiated in a contract set forth and spelled out. It's a cumbersome process right now, I'll give you that. But that's a process that our law provides for today. And what we're looking at really in this bill is just the definition of what marriage is in this state and not letting another state define what that definition is. And we've got some heavy work to do maybe in the future. But that's heavy work for in the future. What we're really doing is defining a marriage between a man and a woman. And I'll leave it at that and ask for your favorable consideration.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I could accept that, except I don't read that. I mean, let's take, for example, look at page 3, lines 1 through 8. And it says, a party to a domestic civil union or marriage, which would be void under subsection A, and subsection A includes a relationship between a husband and wife who was at the time of the marriage was married to somebody else, contracted to marry somebody else. So you've seen the old story. You have a husband and wife. They're married. They get married, and turns out that one of the spouses was already married, either a defect or maybe intentionally. Maybe walked away from the prior marriage 10 years earlier but never got a divorce. That's a void marriage until it gets redone. Now those two couple are living, and then 10 years later, 5 years after they've been living together, in a void relationship, one spouse dies, the other one can't inherit, can't sue, can't take any of the benefits. I mean, if you're trying to capture only those relationships between that you don't think are defined as a marriage, this goes further. The void statutes talk about it, mentally incompetent. So two people that are, one person's incompetent does become married, maybe have children. And it's a void relationship if somebody went to court and voided it. One spouse dies, now they can't inherit, they can't receive benefits because it's a void relationship. I mean, this goes much further than that. It deals with the consequences that though inappropriate, there are relationships between men and women, one man and one woman, that would cause consequences to that I don't think we'd be willing to live with.
Senator Perkins, excuse me.
Ray bad, Drew good. The
Mr. Chairman, just again, let's if we focus on what I believe this bill does, is we already have in statute on 21-101 that a marriage is a civil contract between a male and a female person to which consent of the parties capable of contracting is essential. That's what marriage is in Wyoming. That's what it's been for a long time. This bill doesn't change that. What this bill does is say, it says that if someone else marries, enters into a contract in another jurisdiction, whether it be another state or another country, when they come to this state, is that marriage contract going to be recognized? In other words, will they receive the same benefits and the same consideration, or the lack thereof, that individuals living in Wyoming who either were married or are not married under Wyoming law will receive? And so what we're saying, where the law is right now is, if you are married, whether it's a polygamous relationship, whether it's a same-sex relationship, in another state, and you come into Wyoming, under the law, where the law is right now, they have more benefits than a similar situated couple in Wyoming, because Wyoming already defines that relationship as void. Because in Wyoming, a couple, if they're same-sex, can't be recognized as husband and wife. That's what the law is today. If you have a polygamous marriage, or you have, in fact, there's a case, this is just as the good senator from Albany County said before, a woman walked away from marriage 10 years before, or a significant period of time before, later fell in love and married another man without ever dissolving the first marriage. Then her second husband dies, and the question was, could she inherit? And the answer was no, she couldn't, because her second marriage is void because she never terminated the first marriage, even though the first husband had already died. Until she went back and did just as the good senator from Albany said, until she redid the marriage, until she was married again in Wyoming between husband and wife, she was unable to inherit. So what you have before you is saying that we will actually grant more benefits to someone who is from out of state in a different relationship, moves to Wyoming. They get more rights than similarly situated people in Wyoming. What the bill says is that those individuals, when they come to Wyoming, they're in the same boat as everybody else is in Wyoming with respect to a same-sex or polygamous or other void marriage relationship. That's what the bill did. That's what the bill does today. It may be perceived as a political statement. Indeed, by some it is. By others, it is simply a recognition of that's the way the law is today, and that's what this bill does. There was a bill that passed out of here a couple of years ago that did a similar thing. This one goes a little bit further in defining that the good senator from Albany County has pointed those out on page 3 of the bill in subsection H. But that's what the bill does. And that's what your vote does today, is make that determination. That's a policy determination for you.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that last point, there were some interesting phrases, interesting thoughts that I'd like to bring forward. And one of them is this concept of we want to make sure that people who come to the state of Wyoming don't have more rights and more benefits than our people. So the path we're taking to solve that is to take away their rights and benefits too. There's obviously, Mr. Chairman, another side, another possibility to close the so-called loophole, which I don't really see any problem with, but we're still closing this loophole, and that other side would be to just recognize the rights for our own people. But I don't hear that being proposed as a solution. It's just as good. In fact, it is more benefits and more rights, which my understanding that's an imperative that we keep hearing from the people. People want more rights. They want more benefits. They want smaller government. And the way we're going to respond to that with this piece of legislation, apparently, is to take away benefits and take away rights, not just of the people of Wyoming, which we've already done, but make sure that the people who come here from other states, Mr. Chairman, lose those same rights. That's our equity. That's the equality that we're shooting for, is to make sure that we punish all equally when they come to the state of Wyoming. I guess that is equality, but it's not the equality I want to aspire to, Mr. Chairman. And I'm concerned about that. And we're talking now also about the fact that we're just trying to clarify things, clear things up, that we don't currently have a policy, but that SJ5 would allow for such a policy. And that may be true. But as far as a policy on civil unions, this probably will be our first. This is a policy on civil unions, and the way it reads is a party to a domestic civil union would be void under subsection A. So I'm not entirely sure that that is a policy that allows for civil unions. The way I read that, what with the void word and all, tends to imply that it is taking away the possibility of civil unions. And the only way we could have them in the future is if we wanted to heavily amend out this subsection H to allow for it. And if that's really what we're aspiring to is clarity, why don't we have five more pages of detail here that talk about how a civil union would be legally recognized within the state of Wyoming? And I think there's a reason for that, which is that we don't want that policy under this particular bill. The people that are pushing for this bill don't want that recognition. They want to be voiding out-of-state marriages. And once again, I'm going to call for the same question of the sponsors that I've heard from two or three other senators here. How does this help the people of Wyoming? What is this giving us? What benefits does this provide us? Mr. Chairman, how does this help us?
Further comment? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, part of this discussion really bothers me, and I want to talk to that issue. The opponents of this bill want to solicit and try to deceive you with the idea that this thing is just egregiously flawed, so we need to just kill it on the first reading. We all know the process. If you find provisions, and what I've heard from the discussion from the opponents of this, it all revolves around this one little section back on lines 3 and 4. What I would say is avail yourself of the process. Second reading, bring an amendment. But in the meantime, if your intent is just to kill the bill, kill the bill. But if you want to sit here and try to play fear tactics and solicit and use deceptive direction as to what we should do here, I would say let's pass it. Avail yourself of the opportunity to bring the amendments in the second reading. I ask for favorable consideration of this bill.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Let me be very clear. We should kill this bill. We should kill it right now. But we should kill it because the bill's not very well thought out. It has enormous practical implications that we actually haven't even grasped about. And that's not hyperbole. It says that any person that's a party to a civil union or a marriage that becomes void because of this bill shall not be entitled to the legal obligations, responsibilities, protections, or benefits afforded or recognized by law of Wyoming to married persons and spouses, whether they derive from statute, administrative rule, policy, common law, or any other source of civil or criminal law. That's what it says. How do I fix that? I mean, honestly, how do I fix that without changing the bill's intent? I can't do that. But what I can tell you, you know, we talk about how there are other administrative remedies for people that want to enjoy these benefits. This is just a little obstacle, but they've got all these other things they can do. They can go see a lawyer. They can have a living will drawn up. They can do this and that and that. Well, in part, that might be kind of true. But you're making some people go a lot farther to achieve the same benefits that are available to other people. But you might be right. For people that live here, work in Wyoming and made a commitment and want to take months to get these things done to achieve the same benefits under this law. But what about all the millions of people that visit Wyoming, that just come for vacation, that pass through on I-80, and events envelop and take up and change their lives irreparably at that moment? And they didn't have the time to make a living will. They didn't have the time to talk to a lawyer. They didn't have a time to get their life insurance policy with both benefits. They didn't have time to do all that because life and events took them over. And it happens all the time. All these millions of visitors, and we're so proud of our visitors. They're very important to Wyoming. Now we're going to say, well, all of you visitors who happen to be, from another state, can you come across the border? You're magically, you're not together anymore. Poof, it's over. Be careful when you're in Wyoming. Don't get in a car wreck. Don't get mad at each other and try and have a fight. Don't, you know, come on. It doesn't work. It can't be made to work. And frankly, without passing SJ-5 first, it's not even constitutional. Article 1, Section 3. Kill it now.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 74, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
Chairman, division being called for. All those in favor of House Bill 74, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. House Bill 74 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration will be House Bill 110. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 110, Successor Corporation Asbestos-Related Liability Act 2. And Act Relating to Civil Action, sponsored by the Mineral Committee. It was assigned to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a recommendation that House Bill 110, Successor Corporation Asbestos-Related Liability Act 2, do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I will explain the reasoning for the bill and walk you through the bill. Members of the Senate, a situation occurred to a corporation that employs a lot of people in Wyoming where they acquired in the 1960s a company for certain reasons that had a plan that would merge with what they were doing and the business they were involved in. Unbeknownst to them, this company had been involved in some manufacturing and building of asbestos-related products. After they had completed it, and it was a merger where they merged that company into the parent corporation, they found out about the asbestos liability, and for the past many, many, many years have been involved in extensive litigation. The testimony presented to the Minerals Committee on this particular bill during the interim when we worked on it and also when we heard it in the Senate Minerals Committee is that the acquisition of that particular company is for around $6 or $7 million, and the claims that they had paid as of the date that we had heard from them was $650 million. And Mr. Chairman, what this bill attempts to do is provide some related liability immunity to those particular companies relative to the unknown effect and what happened to them and to set up a mechanism so that based on the value of that particular company when they bought it, that there is some protection afforded to the people that had asbestos claims. And Mr. Chairman, to walk you through the bill very quickly, the definition sections, a very clear definition about what an asbestos claim is. We talk about a corporation on page 2. We talk about successor, and we talk about a successor asbestos-related liabilities, and that's on page 3. And there, again, it's an important definition. And it goes on to say, means any liability, whether known or unknown, asserted or unasserted, absolute or contingent, accrued or unaccrued, liquidated or unliquidated, so on and so forth, to be clear that there is a liability there, and it goes on to the plan of merger of the successor corporation. You turn the page on to page 4, Mr. Chairman, it talks about the transferor. It means a corporation from which successor asbestos-related liabilities are were assumed or occurred. Then we get into the guts of the bill and what we're trying to do. And first of all, we talk about the applicability on 1-1-133. And these are the exclusions, things that will not be limited in the liability. And one is any kind of a workers' comp benefit or claim. That's under B little I on page 4, line 17. And then on line 22, any claim against a corporation that does not constitute a successor asbestos-related liability. Anything else that might come up, we're not talking about that. We're only talking about asbestos-related. On page 5, under little 3I, any obligation under the National Labor Relations Act. There again, this is a federal issue, and under collective bargaining agreements, we're not going to get involved in that issue. We're only talking about asbestos-related claims. We go on to say that a successor that after merger or consolidation continues the business of mining it. So if you went out there and bought a particular company or merged it into your corporation that had something to do with asbestos and later on you decided to stay in that business, well then guess what? You're obligated and you're offered or afforded no protection under this. And the last one on page 5, line 11, any claim against a corporation that was filed in court of competent jurisdiction prior to the effective date of this act. And that will be the effective date that's included in here. And the limitations on this, and Mr. Chairman, that gets into how do you come up with a value that's reasonable in this. And we talk about the fair market value of the total gross assets of it. So if you, in fact, purchased that corporation in the 1960s and the value at that time was established, that's a fair market value. And you fast forward and you look on page 6, 1-1-135, that, you know, that's there's a difference in value of money back then compared to today. And so we look at a way to, in fact, do that, and we put some language in there that establishes that fair market value and a going concern value. And you look on page 7, we have, in the absence of readily available information from which the fair market value can be determined, we can look at the assets on the balance sheet. And another important part of it, Mr. Chairman, on page 7, total gross assets include intangible assets. That could be the going concern value of a particular company that you were to buy. And then you go on to the, Mr. Chairman, on page 7, one of the things that I think is very important, if there's any liability insurance that's out there that this particular corporation that you purchased had, all that remains in effect. We do not get involved in that or affect that in any way, shape, or form. So if they have $1 million worth of coverage, $10 million, whatever, that remains there and is available to the people that are involved in the litigation. And, Mr. Chairman, on page 8, we get into the adjustment to bring the cost of that acquisition that may have occurred in the 60s to the present day. And that adjustment is we go on page 8, lines 15. We talk about the prime rate as listed in the Wall Street Journal. And we add a 1% inflation factor, and that is compounded. And someone explained to me that if you purchased a company for, like, $10 million, I think that value today would be $100 million. So that's the amount of money that the successor corporation that had purchased or merged this other corporation into it would have in terms of having to have money available for the claims that might come in. Mr. Chairman, one of the important things, too, is the date that this is effective, and that is there's a standing or committee of the whole amendment that deals with that date. And if you look, Mr. Chairman, on page 3 on line 5, it says the successor before January 1, 1972, the magic of that date is that's when OSHA recognized that asbestos could cause some serious harm, as we all know that it does to people that are around it or work in those kind of situations, and that was a date that we put in there. There's a committee of the whole amendment that deals with that, and I'll be glad to explain that and get into that. And, Mr. Chairman, that is the bill. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Discussion on the amendment? The amendment's not been read in. Does somebody want to move that amendment? Okay. The clerk will read in the amendment.
House Bill 110, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 5.
Now, does anybody want to move that amendment? Senator Cooper.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment. Number 1 to House Bill 110. Fellow Senators, what this does is, of course, amends on page 3, line 5, the date there. It strikes the January 1, 1972 date and replaces it with the May 13, 1968 date. Well, Senators, what this is about is that there was some concern out there that if we use the 1972 date, that there's was a good possibility that there was some folks here in our state that could be disadvantaged and adversely affected by this other date. And so and the reason for that was because the original Occupational Safety and Health Administration Act came out in January 1 of 1972. However, there was actually some other work that had been done on this by the American Conference of Governmental Industrial Hygienists, which is an organization working with local, state, and federal health officials. And they first adopted a change and recommended long-standing problems with asbestos in the workplace as early as this the new date we've put in here, which is May 13, 1968. So it was felt that that 1972 date was problematic for citizens of our state. So we wanted to amend it back to the other date, so we wouldn't let those people out in the cold with any problems that they may develop. And that's the amendment, Mr. Chairman. Stand for questions.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Cooper's motion to adopt amendment number 1 to House Bill 110, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was the no vote in committee on this bill, and it turns out I'm probably going to be a no vote on the floor on this bill as well. You know, this was one that it's a well-written bill, I can assure you of that, but it accomplishes, I think, what the one particular corporation that wants this bill to come to fruition wants, which is to basically remove any possibility of liability in the state of Wyoming in the future. The valuation of this particular incident is about $70 million is what the formula will estimate their liability, their net possible liability at. They claim a total of over $600 million in total liability, Mr. Chairman, which means they're about $500 million past the possibility of anyone ever getting any money out of them again if this particular bill goes through, at least relative to the state of Wyoming. They've been shopping this bill around to a lot of other states to make sure that they can do that. And the reason for it, the purpose behind it, is because they want a better interest rate and they want to have a better bond rating. That's what this bill does. It's one corporation looking for a better interest rate and a better bond rating, which I can understand. I can certainly understand that. That's definitely in their interest. But we need to think about whether this is in the interest of the state of Wyoming and the people of Wyoming, because we are effectively waiving the possibility in the future of anyone from the state claiming against this corporation with regard to asbestos claims. It's very unlikely. You know, you look at the operations of this particular business, and there's almost no chance it's going to happen. But we're ensuring that they won't have to pay out and that the best anybody can ever get is workman's compensation by this particular bill. You know, when you think about this, again, it's understandable to think, well, they didn't really mean to buy a corporation that had liability. And I get that. Nobody wants to buy a corporation that has a liability that you don't see. But that's kind of the nature of business. Sometimes you make a good decision. Sometimes you make a bad decision. You kind of have to live with those decisions in a free market. I think a lot of the people in this room support free market. And this is one of the bad decisions they made. It's come back to sting them. How badly? Well, not really that badly. This is a corporation that has $6 billion in market capitalization, and the CEO of this particular corporation made $20 million-ish last year and $50 million over the last 5 years. But they want further protection because my assumption is that $20 million isn't enough to buy the really big boat. This is a bill that tries to get the bigger boat, Mr. Chairman. But it's nothing for the people of Wyoming. There's nothing in here for us. If somebody comes after we pass this bill and says, you know, I've got an asbestos claim, I have mesothelioma, what can we do? Do I have any action available? The answer is going to be no. So this is a bill for a corporation that is headquartered outside the state of Wyoming, as my friend from KC likes to say, a foreign corporation. It's for them. If you want to vote for it for them, I understand that. But this is certainly not a vote for the people of Wyoming. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments, and I appreciate my colleague from Albany County's concern about this. The workers' comp claims, if there were to be any, and of course we don't waive those rights, would be in other states, unless for some reason somebody that happened to work for this corporation in the 60s now lives here, and then again, I don't think workers' comp in our state would comply. You know, buying a bigger boat, I will submit to you that the testimony we heard that this particular corporation has a large presence in our state, in the Bighorn Basin, and they do have a lot of jobs that they have up there and they've created. And in reality, what's happened, Mr. Chairman, is that as these lawsuits have come forward and as they've tried to do expansion of their business, retention of their business, they've had to downsize substantially. And I can't remember exactly, maybe one of the members of the committee can recall the number of jobs that were lost and entities they had to sell off to be able to come up with the cash to pay these claims. And the claims were valid and they were paid. That happened years ago. And they've been able to come back from that, but it had a significant impact. They do have a big presence in Wyoming, so there's an important thing there. And on the mesothelioma, you know, I really think that if they had contracted that in the 60s, we would have known about it now. But certainly there's some protection afforded to those people. And by moving the act from the 71 date back to the 68 date, should in fact anyone fall into that crack, they will be liable. They'll be able to proceed in that regard. And from the testimony we had, I don't think there's any litigation going on in our state right now relative to this.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, I seriously question whether or not this bill is constitutional. Article 3, Section 27, special and local laws prohibited. And it prevents this legislature from passing any laws that grant any special or exclusive privilege, immunity, and that's what this bill does, folks. It grants immunity or franchise whatsoever. Further, Article 10, Section 4 of the Constitution, damages for personal injury or death, workers' compensation. No law shall be enacted limiting the amount of damages recovered for causing the injury or death of any person. Take this into mind when you pass this kind of legislation. Yes, we want to be business friendly in Wyoming, but at what cost? At what cost to our workers? At what cost to our individuals? We already heard that there isn't really much litigation going on with regards to this. The good senator from Albany County is absolutely right. This is all about getting better ratings. That's all it's about. And these people are well-heeled, folks, if you don't think so. $50 million, the CEO, over the last 5 years. Give me a break.
Further discussion, Senator Nicholas.
General, I guess my inquiry is the... if this is a liability that already exists, that is... these, whoever the victims are, that they've already been exposed, you can't pass laws to affect liability of things that have already taken place. You can't pass a law ex post facto, if you will, to come in and say, we're going to amend and change whatever responsibilities already existed. So I don't see how any statute providing immunity, you can come in and say, well, you've already committed the deed, you acquired a company that made the deed, and we're going to limit your liability. You can't do it. It is what it is. Now, if there's a company in Wyoming that's presently exposing our citizens to a risk going forward, why would we ever give immunity to protect somebody going forward? So it seems to me it's either one or the there. Going back, we have no business creating laws to try to change whatever obligations exist for things that have already taken place. Going forward, if people are injuring our citizens and exposing them to asbestos when they shouldn't be, why would we ever give anybody immunity for that?
Senator DeBeebout.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things, and we had some concerns about this as well when we worked the bill, and I can cite you cases and a lot of things. Just on the equal protection and due process guarantees, we looked at some Supreme Court decision, Mountain Fuel Supply versus Emerson, Allison versus State, and we felt the language there was such that it supported what we were trying to do. The issues of precluded liability in terms of the one part of the Constitution about limiting damages, you know, we already have many, many parts of our law that talk about where we preclude liability, and I will go through some of these. Protection of alcoholic beverages, Statute 12A301 upheld in Greenwald versus Ram Restaurant. Food makers and sellers. Inherent risk of recreation and equine activities, Wyoming Statute 1-1-121. And the list goes on, members of the Senate. There's probably about 10 or 15 situations where we do that. We felt that this bill had merit. We felt that it was constitutional. And I would ask for your support.
Senator Case.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there might be an issue here that I'm not totally clear on, and I'd appreciate some help. But the question that has been discussed with me is whether, you know, there's a difference between limiting the amount of damages or, limiting, or let's say the right to recover and the limitation of that amount being separate issues. Now, how does that play out? Because what this, you know, is saying, we're talking about a company here who bought another company a long, long, long time ago. They do business in Wyoming, and they're trying to say, we want to limit the total exposure. And that's why this is here. It applies to any company that's in a similar situation. But isn't it true that the Supreme Court of Wyoming has limited the types of actions that can be brought without limiting damages? I mean, that's my understanding. And there's cases, and you know I've got a cheat sheet just like y'all do, so help me with these cases. But there's one, Mayer versus Kendig, and the Wyoming Supreme Court in Costco versus Lampert. I think we probably ought to look into this a little bit more, because Lord knows, some days I try to play a lawyer in here, but I want to tell you, Mr. Chairman, I'm not even close. But I don't think we should kill this on this reading. I think we should get some answers to whether there is a difference here before you decide as we move forward. And that would be my recommendation.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think this is an excellent reading to kill this bill. Mr. Chairman, what we're doing, even if we have the legal standing, and I'm not entirely convinced we do. In fact, I tend to agree with the legal sense from Laramie County and from Albany County that indicate that this is a violation of the Constitution. But even if we did have that standing, what we're doing is saying, all right, well, we've got the standing, so now we can say that we're waiving any future liability, any possibility of additional liability. And instead, if there is a problem, the state of Wyoming will pick up the tab through workers' compensation. That's what we're saying. They're not going to give us the funds to fund workers' compensation. We're going to pick up the tab. So that's the best case scenario. That's if everything in this bill does just exactly what we hope it does. That's the best case. The worst case is that it's wholly and completely unconstitutional and we can't do it. I don't want to vote for the best case scenario any more than I want to vote for the worst case scenario. So I'm not particularly compelled, and I'd certainly urge a no vote on this bill.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things. On workers' comp, read the bill, members of the Senate. On page 4, under applicability, line 17, workers' compensation benefits paid or honored before behalf of the employer, that's an exclusion. Now you're talking about our Wyoming workers' compensation paying for somebody that may or may not have contracted a problem or something in a company that existed in 1960? It's just not going to happen. It's just not a thing that's there. We put that language in there for a comparable workers' comp law of another jurisdiction. About the liability issue, as I understand this bill, and I could be very wrong on it, but we're not taking away those rights of those people. We're limiting the amount of exposure this company has that acquired the company in the merger. And that gets into the talk of the language about the establishing the fair market value of it and the way we adjust it to inflation. So if somebody in between, and we even go as far as to say between 1968, we took the date back to 68 now, and if someone falls in that crack, then they can come, they can bring their litigation, they can claim, and if they prevail, then they're protected to the extent they've been damaged based on the merits of this bill.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to ask for a point of order. When we have discussion on these bills, could we please keep it germane to the discussion? It's absolutely superfluous to discuss what somebody makes or doesn't make for a company. So, quite finally, I think that's very offensive that that would even come up. Keep it germane to the bill.
Any more discussion on the bill? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Bebout's motion to win the Committee of the Whole rise report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 110, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
Senate division. All those in favor of House Bill 110, please rise. All those in favor, all those opposed, please stand. House Bill 110 has passed Committee of the Whole. Chair recognizes President Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, sir.
Today we're joined in the gallery by Mr. Oscar Yildiz, who is the president of the West American Turkic Council. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Yildiz. Continue for a minute, Mr. Chairman. You may recall that you recently, as members of the body, received an invitation from the West American Turkic Council to attend a reception and dinner next Thursday night, February 24th. That is to be at 6:30 p.m. at Little America. This reception will feature Turkish cuisine, a special Turkish coffee presentation, and tasting, as well as an overview of potential partnerships between the country of Turkey and the state of Wyoming. Mr. Yildiz and members of his delegation will be in the lobby for the next hour to answer any questions you may have about this event. He is also available to discuss the goals of his organization to promote intercultural dialogue between Wyoming, Turkish Americans, and the Republic of Turkey. And again, thank you for being here today.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 111. The reading clerk will read in the bill.
House Bill 111, Public Works and Contracts 2, an act relating to public works and contracts, sponsored by the Minerals Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Mineral Business Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Senators, what is your pleasure? Senator Bebout?
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a recommendation in House Bill 111, Public Works and Contracts 2, do pass. There is no standing committee amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I will explain the bill. This is a bill that was on work that was conducted by the Minerals Committee during the interim. And the purpose of this bill, and there's been a lot of discussion about ensuring that we, in fact, do have the 5% and the contractor's preference for projects that we utilize state funds to build schools or what other facilities within our state. And, Mr. Chairman, there was a law that was passed in the, I believe in 2007, to take care of a particularly large corporation that's headquartered here in Cheyenne that felt like they were being mistreated under the contractor's preference. And that law did pass. And what it did, though, Mr. Chairman, is it created a loophole in the existing law that we do have. And so the purpose of this bill, Mr. Chairman, is to plug that loophole. And what was happening, and the reason it was brought to our attention, is that the same old situation that existed many times in the past when we talk about contractors' preferences, that somebody would come into Wyoming, they would hang a shingle out, have an answering machine, have an LLC or an S-Corp, whatever the case may be, and set up and claim to be a Wyoming contractor and get the preference considerations. And, Mr. Chairman, your Minerals Committee just didn't feel that was right. So we got together and you began working on public works and contracts and House Bill 111. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to go through the bill and explain it and tell you where the items that occurred and some of the things that we tried to correct and how we did it. And, Mr. Chairman, if you look on page 2 under the, and this is all under 16.6.101, the definition section, one of the important things we put in this bill that has not been in the law before, if you look on that on line 7, it says, the Department of Employment, following receipt of an affidavit executed by the president of the company or his designee of compliance with this act. I think that's very important. And what we're saying now is there's a lot of people may try to get around this, and if they're going to try to get around our law, then they're going to have to sign this. And if they knowingly do it, they're opening themselves up to some considerable amount of exposure. Then we go on and we define the C under item C on page 2, a corporation organized under the laws of this state. And this is an area where we had some concern before. And if you look at the language, we talk about the 50% ownership on lines 15. And then we go down to lines 21 and we say, which has maintained its principal office and place of business within the state for at least 1 year. We felt like that this 1 year thing has been consistent with previous law. It made a lot of sense to do that, and that those are clarifications of that, Mr. Chairman. And then we get over on to page 3, little J, and this is where we took care of the situation for the corporation, the larger corporation that's here in the state of Wyoming that had not felt they would have been treated before, and that was properly before, and that's why we changed the law in 2007. If you look at the language, it says a corporation organized under the laws of any state. So this clearly allows them to do that. They've got a 2 year existence period in there. Then we put some language that was in the existing law about they have continuously maintained a principal office and place of business for 1 year, and that they've continuously employed not at least 15 full-time Wyoming resident employees. They paid workers' comp, and they're a business entity which qualifies as a resident pursuant to paragraph shall not lose that residency solely to conversion. And Mr. Chairman, what that does is that affords the same protection that the previous bill had, and yet we put back into the bill the C-Corp protection for Wyoming businesses that are truly Wyoming businesses. We go further on under 2I, that we talk about a principal office, a place of business, and we further define that to include the high-level offices or management direct control and coordinate the business activities. There again, we're trying to tighten this up and make sure that they really are Wyoming resident contracts. And if you go on to the bottom of page 4, the department shall make investigations. It was May. We decided that we know if we're going to have this kind of a law and a good enforceable law that they shall make those investigations. And then on the bottom of page 5, we say the burden of proof regarding the status of the residency is on the person whose residency is in question. That only seems right. If you're trying to get around the law, you ought to prove that you're not. Then we have on 16.6.104, and you look at the top of page 6, that's cleanup. Mr. Chairman, that language exists in other parts of our statutes, 16.6-203, and we cleaned that up. Then there was some concern about brought to the attention of the committee about the fine, and they wanted to raise the fine from $500 to $750. That's included on 16.6-111. And then we gave the department rulemaking authority to, in fact, do these rules. And if you look further on page 7, we had the fine language in there is, again, $750 for each violation, for each state during which the violation continues. And then we say that you're barred from bidding on any state your state contract or submitting any request for proposal on any state contract for 1 year from the violation. And, Mr. Chairman, that really is what the bill does. The repealer on the back, if you look at page 8, 16.6.101A1H, that is a part of the statute that created the problem in the first place by allowing a special provision for one large corporation, and, in fact, circumvented the rest of the law that allowed all these corporations to come in our state and hang a shingle. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to answer any questions about the bill. Mr. Chairman?
There is an amendment on the bill. Will the reading clerk? Oh.
Mr. Chairman, will the reading clerk please read in committee the whole amendment number 1?
House Bill 111, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, to engross copy, page 4, line 8.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, and members of the Senate, this is just a cleanup. If you look at the existing law, the word principle was not in there, and we had to underline it to be consistent with our statutes and the way we draft our bills, and so it's a cleanup, and I would ask for your support.
Before the question was called. Senator Hines had a question. Do you want to speak, Senator Hines?
Mr. Chairman, my question is on the bill, not on the amendment.
Okay. Question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Bebaugh's motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 110-111, would you please say aye?
Aye.
Those opposed say no. That amendment is passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, for clarification on page 3, I have a couple of questions there on line 6 through 8 when it talks about a corporation being in existence for 2 years, then does this eliminate a corporation that is forming a new corporation and just coming in? And also on that section there on line 14 through 18 where they have to have not less than 15 employees, then again, does this eliminate the small companies?
Senator Bebaugh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good questions. The answer is no, it does not. And I'll explain that to you. If you look at on page 3, it says a corporation organized under the laws of any state. So this would be a state that could be Wyoming, but it certainly could be outside the state of Wyoming. And if, in fact, that's the case, then they have to comply with these requirements. But if you go back to subtitle C, and look under there, C, and then also an existing law, it's a corporation organized under the laws of the state of Wyoming, then it's a one-year period. But it also goes on, it defines a resident. And so if you're a resident, and if you look at the statutes, any person who has been a resident of the state for 1 year or more, so what would happen, Mr. Chairman, is that if I was had lived in Wyoming for more than 1 year and I wanted to start my own business, whether it's an LLC, a C-Corp, or an S-Corp, under the way this bill is drafted, I can do that. I do not have to comply with the 15 employees, nor do I have to comply with the other language that's listed under J, because I'm a Wyoming corporation. But if I'm an out-of-state corporation and I want to do that, then I have a 2-year period, and I come into the state, then those different conditions would apply.
Any more discussion on the bill? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Bebaugh's motion to win the Committee of the Whole rise to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation to House Bill 111, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. That bill is passed. House Bill 111 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 143. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 143, Manufacturing Tax Exemption, and Act Relating to Taxation and Revenue, sponsored by Representative Miller. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Emmerich, Hines, Perkins. No, Senator Case, Senator Hines, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 143. There is also a standing committee amendment, and I'll move that amendment. Ask the reading clerk to read it in, and then I'll yield to the Senate sponsor, Senator Martin.
The reading clerk will read in the amendment.
House Bill 143, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 3.
Discussion of the amendment. Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to take up the amendment. It's pretty simple, and then we'll move on to the bill. The amendment is, you'll find it in two places in the bill, page 3, line 3, where they remove... In the new language on line 3, where it starts by saying classified by the 2007 edition, what they would put in there after edition as amended. Page 4, line 13, would be the same change after addition as amended. And what that does is that North American code is updated every 5 years. And so with that amendment, it would actually allow them to utilize the most current version that would be available to the Department of Employment and to the Department of Revenue. So with that explanation, I would call for the question on the amendment.
Any further discussion on that amendment? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 143, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That amendment has carried. We are back on the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 143, Manufacturing Equipment Sales Tax Exemption, is for equipment used in the process of manufacturing a product. All other taxes are still collected. In the past 6 years, since it was first authorized, an average of $10 million a year has been granted in exemptions. However, until the recession, state and local taxes from manufacturing had actually increased. With the adoption of the manufacturing equipment sales tax exemption 6 years ago, manufacturing in Wyoming has steadily increased until 2008. During the recession, Wyoming's manufacturing did not have as steep of a decline as in the rest of the United States. Because of the exemption, the manufacturer actually ends up paying more taxes as the value of their plants increase. And for example, one recipient earned $2.6 million in tax exemptions but paid $15 million in property and other taxes. Manufacturers in various categories covered by the legislation testified in many cases their expansion and the size of expansion was greatly influenced by the available exemption. In general, the exemption helps to improve the anticipated rate of return on affected investments and thereby encourages the decision to invest. Modernization is essential to being able to compete in a global market. And if you remember, there was an announcement regarding a manufacturer moving into this community. The announcement took place yesterday. This exemption was key to bringing that manufacturer here to this state. More than 30 states currently offer the exemption, and Wyoming's sales tax exemption is a key to retaining and recruiting new manufacturers. Manufacturing brings outside dollars into the state with high-paid jobs and benefits. It provides a diversified job base for Wyoming, reducing our dependence on the energy sector. Consistency is critical in keeping and recruiting manufacturers. House Bill 143 adds accountability requirements in order to track jobs and other results from the exemption. Mr. Chairman, I'll quickly walk the body through the bill. Section 1 on page 1, lines 8 through 10, states that we are amending Wyoming Statutes 3915-105, sales tax exemptions, and Wyoming Statute 3916-105, use tax exemptions. The first change is on page 2 to Wyoming Statute 3915-106, subsection A, paragraph 8, subparagraph O, and this changes the sunset date from December 31st, 2011 to December 31st, 2017, which is a, that would be a year of the general session. The next change is in subsection B on page 2, the end of line 10 and the beginning of line 11. This change adds the Department of Employment to the reporting requirements in subsection B. And the new language starts on line 15 through line 19. And the new language states that if requested by the Department of Revenue, any person utilizing the exemption under subparagraph O of this section shall report to the department the amount of sales tax exempted and the number of jobs created or impacted by the utilization of the exemption. The last change to Wyoming Statute 3915.105, subsection B, paragraph 1, page 3, lines 3 through 6, adds the language classified by the 2007 edition, and we the amendment would that we had come in at this place, as amended, of the North American Industry Classification System, NAICS, Code Manufacturing Sections 31 through 33, from information collected by the Department of Employment. And if you look into the North American Industry Classification System, Code Section 31 is for manufacturing, 32 is for wood product manufacturing, and I'd back up 31 for manufacturing, and they have 188 subsections in that section. 32 would be wood product manufacturing, 209 subsections, and 33 primary metal manufacturing with 367 different subsections. You'll find the same changes as I previously discussed to Wyoming Statute 3916.105 in the use tax statute, starting on page 3, line 17, which changes the sunset date, and page 4, lines 2 through 7, and lines 13 through line 16. Mr. Chairman, that's a quick review of the bill, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion to win the committee of the whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 143, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. House Bill 143 has passed committee of the whole. Senator Von Flatron. Permission granted.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd just like to explain a little bit to the body about the motion point of order. It's actually a question. It is not for the member to make the point of order. He can ask it as a question, as in, Mr. Chairman, do we usually have two readings, or we usually have a second, and he would say yes or no. As Mason says, it's the right of every member who notices a breach of order or a rule to assist upon its enforcement. This is called raising a question or point of order, because the member puts to the presiding officer the question as to whether there's been a breach of order or of the rules. It is the duty of the presiding officer to maintain order and enforce the rules. In other words, you don't decide that there's been a germaneness, and I only do this because it has happened several times. You just say, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, I believe that that is not germane to the bill, blah, blah. They decide that point.
Senator Rothfuss. Senator Nicholas, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple points on that. First of all, with respect to the point of order, and you can read beginning in your Masons in a variety of different places, the point of order is essentially an objection. And once you say point of order, that stops the proceedings. The chairman on the board, who's ever in the chair at that time, stops, and it takes precedence over all matters. So it's not an order to use point of order as a style of argument. And if you call the point of order, things stop, and the chairman then has to then receive the comment, which is then ruled on. So points of order are a technical term. They stop the proceedings, so it's inappropriate to use them simply in your discussion because, frankly, people don't know how to use them. In part, I said that wrong. They're a technical term. Things stop. A ruling's made, and that's the purpose for it. So you can't build it into your – you can't say a point of order and then make a discussion because that's not the appropriate sense. There's another issue that we need to talk about a little bit, and that's this. If you can articulate an argument within the English language and describe why you think a bill is offensive, without using names and without personalizing it, all debate is fair. I want to know from my colleagues on that are on these subcommittees that this bill is addressed to one entity and that this entity may have large resources. That's information I'm entitled to have. And we've done this a couple times. What is generally inappropriate to do is to personalize the motives of your colleagues. Now, if your colleague stands out of order and uses a personal name, falls outside of the debate, then call a point of order and shut it down. But to use the point of order or any other process to personalize it, so if you look at Mason's, it's a good reminder, 124, personalities are not permitted in debate. A debate, a member must confine remarks to the question before the House and avoid personalities. It is inappropriate to say, I find my colleague's remarks offensive, because now you've personalized it. Now, you could say, I find it offensive to discuss the amount of money that a corporation has, because that's to the point. It's a fine line, but it needs to be adhered to. All comments are generally to be addressed to the chair. And we need to remember that. We have to, we want to have skilled, vigorous debate. And to have that, you just need to keep the issues not addressed to ourselves, our personalities, but to the ideas. Every idea, every word is to be scrutinized and debated. And to avoid the personalities, we address the chair, remarks are to the chair, and we don't challenge the motivations or the personalities or the people making arguments. Rather, we say, okay, if this is your argument, here's what I don't like or here's what I disagree with. And we challenge those. But we don't discourage people from making the arguments. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 153. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 153, Agricultural Gas Tax Refund Program, an act relating to fuel tax, sponsored by Representative Semlick. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Hines?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises
to report, it does so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 153. There is a standing committee amendment. I'll ask the reading clerk to read in the standing committee amendment, and then I'll yield to the Senate sponsors to explain the bill. Senator Schiffer.
The reading clerk will read in standing committee amendment number one.
House Bill 153, standing committee amendment number one, to engross copy, page 4, line 4.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, as I go through the bill, I'll address the standing committee amendment as I go and then call for the question on it after I go through the bill. Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it goes in and updates and makes more efficient the agricultural gas tax refund program. It models it after the diesel program, which we're accustomed to. It takes the fuel marketer out of the loop. Up until this point, the fuel marketer actually has had to pay the taxes and then collect them on behalf of the state. It takes them plumb out of this, places the responsibility on the ag producer to claim whatever his fuel tax exemption should be and collect that tax. It eliminates the old 70-30 split that was the maximum says whatever you're actually using in terms of gasoline on an agricultural enterprise, that's what's exempt so long as it was off the road. It also expands to a certain extent the definition of bulk prior to this wonderful piece of legislation. The only way you could collect the rebate was to have a bulk delivery. What's happened with the price of gasoline the way it is, you can actually drive into town and fill up a 50-gallon drum cheaper than you can get a bulk truck to come out to your ranch and deliver it in bulk. If you're going to use it off the road on your ranch, that's okay. You should be qualified for this gasoline tax refund. Mr. Chairman, I'll walk through the bill. Remember, the pattern for this is to move us into a system that's very much, as a matter of fact, it's a mirror of the diesel tax. On page 2, starting on line 7, we repeal the old thing. We had to get a letter from your accountant and all certifying that you were in ag. We do away with that. We model it just like the diesel. You sign an affidavit that says, I'm in it. By the way, there is a check on this in case some of you are going to nudge the law a little bit. They also bounce this back to your federal tax, and so they know if you're a bona fide. So don't cross over the line, or I'll have to come visit you in somewhere we don't want to visit at. So be careful. If you thought this was opening up wide open, Mr. Chairman, it's not. We've got an eye on you. We go on. We're getting in at the bottom of page 2. We're getting the distributors out of the loop. We don't want them involved anymore, and they don't want to be involved anymore. Tax remedies, we're over in the top of page 3. We've got the refunds. The subparagraphs 4, that's for in areas like this where there are deliveries across state lines. We've got to report it. They're also eligible for those sort of refunds. Starting on line 17, we delineate the gas purchase for ag purposes, and that's the 14 cents a gallon. That is the Wyoming fuel tax, and subparagraph 2, line 20, that takes care of aircraft. You have to submit, and I'm on line 22, a record of purchases, specify the percentage of such purchases qualifying for the refund on a form provided by the department, just like we do for the diesel, along with the receipts detailing the bulk purchased and license taxes paid. The department shall establish by rule a form, and we're on line 4, on page 4, line 4. The word specify the format for, and we cleaned that language up. The format for applying, I think it's a great addition to the bill. And that is the standing committee amendment right there. You have to submit your receipts 1 year following the date of purchase, and then within 60 days, you are going to get your refund for the qualified tax. So there's a time limit for the DOT to do this. The repealer on line 12, that's the that set the upper limit up to 70%. It says if you use 100% of the gasoline purchased on your place for ag purposes, you can claim 100%. Mr. Chairman, that is the bill. One other added benefit to this bill. We do the diesel ag exemption, but because of the complexity of the gasoline ag exemption, Department of Transportation had to go in and hire people to weed through the applications and certify this was a bona fide ag producer. They are expensive. They're part-time. So we're going to eliminate all of that. Actually, your government, WIDOT, is going to operate more efficiently than we've ever seen them operate before because of this keen little bill. That's just an added benefit, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like now to call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment, which improves the bill, and ask for your favorable reaction.
Any more discussion on Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 153? All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion on Standing Committee number 1 to Senate file, to House Bill 153, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. We are back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, that amendment
has passed.
I'd be glad to answer questions on the bill. Question on the bill.
There is an amendment committee whole. I'd like to have the reading clerk read that amendment.
House Bill 153, Committee Hold Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 17.
Any discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1? Oh, excuse me, Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 153. And what I'm doing here is trying to reinstate the 70% that they get the refund on. And then if they have more than 70%, they can verify that they are using that for agriculture purposes. And why I'm doing this, because many people that live in the country are using part of that for agriculture. So they have this amendment, they go back to what they're doing currently. They can claim 70% of it for agriculture purposes to verify all of that each time they apply for an exemption and a refund. This just gives an option. If they're using more than the 70%, they can claim that.
Any more discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1?
Mr. Chairman, consider this amendment. Is the operation of this even more simple and more efficient?
Any more discussion on Amendment Number 1?
You know the form.
Senator Perkins.
So I just want to make sure I understand Committee of the Whole. So what we do here is, from where you get a refund on the gasoline taxes that you've paid, that you actually use, to now that you get at least 70% of those taxes back, and if you use even more than that, you get more than 70% back. But in no case in no case under any scenario, if you qualify for the ag exemption, would you get less than 70% of your taxes back on your fuel on the gasoline tax? Is that how I understand?
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, that is the way the current law. If a producer, that had been in the law, as I understand, for many years, it was arrived years ago at a figure that they figured most people used at least that much in their agriculture purposes. And so I'm offering this amendment so they can use that, or they can go ahead and verify whatever they do use.
Further discussion?
Hello. I'm in the ag. I have to live with this system. And so without the amendment, it's a system that worked a deal for this uttered and let some of us in the ag business out of some taxes we really should owe for operating on the highway. I would urge defeat of the amendment.
Any more discussion on amendment? The House is being called for. All those in committee of the whole amendment number 1 to House Bill 153, please say aye.
Aye.
The opposed say no.
No.
That amendment has failed. We are now back on the bill. Any more discussion on the bill? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report that it deal with the recommendation. House Bill 153, please. Those opposed? House Bill 153 is Committee of the Whole. I recognize Majority Whip Leader Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate stand at ease for a break until sound of the gavel.
All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You doing okay?
Sure.
Haven't done one of those, haven't...
Are you still collecting?
Somebody's doing it.
Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 157.
Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 157, Abolition of Worthier Title Doctrine, an act relating to property conveyances, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Excuse, Senator Burns, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee of the whole rise to report that to do so with favorable recommendation on House Bill 157. For an explanation of the bill, with your permission, I'll go ahead and explain that. Doctrine of Worthier Title. Doctrine of Worthier Title. This is a bill came, and this next few bills came from a group in Wyoming of estate planning attorneys that look at these things carefully and identified a couple of issues. What the Doctrine of Worthier Title is an old English common law rule that was out there for a long time that's intended to prohibit a ward of a feudal lord from passing property free of duties to the feudal lord by trying to pass it, the ward's property to the ward's heirs as a remainder interest. In long story short, it's a long holdover, and ultimately it works to defeat probably the purpose that people have in doing certain types of transfers. Let me give you an example of how the application of this law and why it needs to be abolished would work. Oftentimes we find either in Medicaid planning or even as a parent or a grandparent may get old, that they may convey their house to someone else with a life estate. In other words, they give their house to their heirs, but they reserve for themselves a life estate. When you do that, you split that, and ultimately what the Doctrine of Worthier Title would say is that when that life estate expires, that property comes back to the owner of the property instead of going to the kids where they intended it to go in the first place. And so what that can have in result is you oftentimes find in a Medicaid that when the first spouse goes in the nursing home, the house is then deeded to the second spouse, who oftentimes will at that point in time make a life estate for himself and give the house to the kids. If this works, if the Doctrine of Worthier Title applies, that house could actually come back in his estate and be subject to estate recovery and defeat the plan or whatever they intended. It can also happen with more, with fancier estate planning, where you would give property to your kids but retain an income interest so you get income off a certain property. You intend that to go to your kids, but this doctrine says that unless you do the deed exactly right or unless you prepare the document exactly right, that at the end of your life, when you intended that to go to your kids, it ends up back in your estate, subject potentially to estate taxes or other things. And so this has been this doctrine was abolished in England by statute in 1833. It's been abolished in almost every state in the Union, but however, it still remains effective in Wyoming, sometimes to the detriment and to having significant unintended consequences with people and their ability to do the property. And that's all this bill does, is it goes in there and it talks about in that bottom in G, which is on page 2, which is the bill. It just says flat out the Doctrine of Worthier Title is abolished as a rule of law and as a rule of construction. And then makes it clear that if you have a will or a trust agreement or a beneficiary designation describing the beneficiaries as heirs or heirs of law or next of kin, that does not presumptively create a reversionary interest, which means that it doesn't come back from your state unintended. That's what this bill does. I'm going to ask your favorable consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
There are no amendments to this bill. Are there any more discussion on House Bill 157? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 157, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. House Bill 157 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 158. The reading clerk will read in the bill.
House House Bill 158, Rule Against Perpetuities, an act relating to property, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rise and report to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 158, Rule Against Perpetuities, and for an explanation of this perpetually dull subject, which is very similar to the last one, I ask that you call on the good Senator, Senator Escobel.
Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I bring to you House Bill number 158, Rule Against Perpetuities, and I hope that you would give a favorable response, a due pass recommendation to this bill. The rule against perpetuities, as I recall, comes to us from feudal England, and if I'm not mistaken, it was a way to keep property from being controlled from beyond the grave for an extraordinary amount of time. So this rule was to make sure that at some point that hand from the grave would no longer be able to control property. You've got a handout which talks about the Wyoming Statute 34-1-139 perpetuities. And I'll go over that with you. Until the 1990s, most all of the states followed either the English or American common law rule against perpetuities. In 1996, there were five states that had either repealed their rule against perpetuities or adopted an extended rule. Today, there are more than 20 states who have either repealed or modified the rule against perpetuities. Now, I might mention, Mr. Chair, that this bill also came to us from basically a council of estate planners who work primarily in this field, which is to basically shelter assets provide long-range planning. Wyoming has a constitutional prohibition against perpetuities, Article 1, Section 30, and a statute that implements a constitutional provision, Wyoming Statute 34-1-139. In 1949, Wyoming adopted the American common law rule against perpetuities in place of the English common law rule. And the rule basically states, no interest in real or personal property shall be good unless it must vest not later than 21 years after some life in being at the creation of the interest. That means no trust holding property could last longer than lives in being at the time of creation of the trust plus the 21 years. And I won't go into any depth in terms of trying to explain which life that was in being, but the measurement comes from basically when the trust is created. With a 2003 amendment to the Wyoming Statute 34-1-139, the Wyoming rule against perpetuities was changed to allow trusts not holding real property to last up to 1,000 years. You might ask why 1,000 years, and well, because that way at least it doesn't violate the constitutional prohibition against perpetuities. Although some people might argue, as I think one of a good senator from Sheridan County back in 2003 mentioned that you know, it doesn't really make much difference except maybe to a rock. But by having that 1,000 years, you can have a trust holding property for an extended period of time, but no longer than 1,000 years. The American common law rule against perpetuities was retained for trusts holding real property. The 2003 amendment was structured to require trusts that wanted to take advantage of the extended rule to contain a statement opting out of the common law rule against perpetuities. Since the 2003 amendment, some commentators, and these are the estate planners that we talked about, have expressed the view that an extended rule against perpetuity statute requiring an opt-out of the common law rule will result in the IRS disregarding the extended rule. The reasoning would be that the IRS would interpret the statute as having a common law default rule. There have been some informal communications from the IRS indicating that they agree with the default rule interpretation. The proposed amendments to Section 34-1-139 provide that real property will continue to be subject to the common law rule. Property other than real property will be subject to a 1,000-year rule unless the trust document provides a shorter period. And this is the main part. The requirement is subsection B-1 to opt out of the subsection A common law rule is deleted. The proposed amendments do not change the requirement that any trust holding or owning real property must comply with the common law rule to terminate or vest not later than 21 years after some life in being at the creation of the trust interest in the real property. The proposed amendments will not invalidate any trust that states the common law rule for all trust property. In that case, the document will be stating a perpetuities period shorter than 1,000 years. And, Mr. Chair, that opt-out provision that was deleted is on page 2, Romanet 1. And then, it goes on to say that the trust terms require that any power of appointment over the trust property terminate and all interest in the trust property vest or terminate no later than 1,000 years after the trust creation or such earlier date as set forth in the trust instrument. But the main thrust of this bill, was to delete lines 16, 17, and 18 on page 2. The other part of the bill that I'll refer you to is starts on page 3, line 23, where real property interests for the purpose of subsection A and C of this section shall not include mineral interests or an interest in a corporation, limited liability company, partnership, business trust, or other entity. And that, Mr. Chair, is was a rule against perpetuities, and stand for any questions, and hopefully I can answer them, or if I can't, possibly my colleagues in the Judiciary Committee might be able to help me out.
Thank you, Senator Bebout.
Just a quick question, and I think I understand what we're doing here. The question I have is, for those of us that have trust, whether it be a marital, a living trust, a revocable trust, whatever it may be, will this in fact change anything other than the way it's drafted? That's the first question. And the second question, and this is under existing law where it talks about the mineral interest a real property shall not include a mineral interest. Under the IRS code and 1031 exchanges, they have concluded that a mineral interest is in fact a real property. And I guess that's probably under a different section of the code or our statutes, or probably isn't relative, but maybe you could address that too.
Senator Escobel.
Mr. Chair, I would think that for purposes of this bill, subsections A and C, in this case, real property would not include mineral interests. Now, we might be talking about a different kind of a trust, that part I would not be able to answer, Senator. But in regard to your first question, from what I understand is that the proposed amendments to this bill will not invalidate any trust that states the common law rule for all trust property. In that case, the document will be stating a perpetuities period shorter than 1,000 years. So whatever years the trust that you might be talking about has in its body, I would imagine that would be the termination date, but it would not invalidate the trust.
Okay, recognizes Senator Perkins.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Escobel is exactly right. It's not going to invalidate the trust. Your trust, almost every trust, is already going to have a savings clause that says no matter what else we say in this trust, it's not going to be subject. They're going to restate the rule against perpetuities, which is simply a trust is invalid. I mean, that's the common law rule. Trust is invalid unless It terminates by terms within 21 years of the death of lives and being at the time the trust is created. Nobody understands what that means. And if there's some screwy set of facts in your trust or that you can come up with, some of you may have heard of one of the terms in estate planning is called the fertile octogenarian. There could be some interesting situation where you come up with some ability that this wouldn't terminate under those terms. The trust is no good. And so you throw this out, and what this now says is this common law, we're opting out, and so this is going to be effective even if you don't have a savings clause in your trust. So it shouldn't change your trust. With respect to the mineral interest, what that is just carving out, although this doesn't change the character of mineral interest from real property except for purposes of this document. And so what this would do is sometimes you can have a significant mineral trust that provides for family members or a generation skipping tax transfer, a generation skipping trust that could hold a mineral interest that would pay out to kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, and you could have that, and it wouldn't be subject to rule against perpetuities. You could have that longer period, so it could be 1,000 years, 500 years, 100 years, whatever term you wanted to have. It would be shorter than 1,000 years.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions with respect to that. I mean, in a perfect world, I think we would want to keep our rule of perpetuities. The reason we created these rules is in Europe years ago, all the wealth, all the cash got concentrated in a few families, and there just wasn't any wealth passed on. And ultimately, the question is what do you get to control after your death forever? And if all the wealth gets turned into trust and the trusts are running everything, it's great for the banks. It's great for those trust officers that are running all the assets, but doesn't create new wealth. It's just held there. It's not creating jobs. The idea is when you're dead, you give your money to your kids and they spend it. Or they do whatever what. But the wealth gets turned around. Now, the trust officers, though, say, look, other states have gotten rid of the rule of perpetuities. And there's these huge trusts, and they could come and they could be managed in our banks, and there's plenty of wealth in the world that it's okay to concentrate wealth in these trusts. So several years ago, we said, fine, you can, we'll go ahead and make an exception to the rule of perpetuities for personal property because there's plenty of cash out there. And there's plenty of resources, and we'll allow you to set up a trust and make it for one purpose so your kids can't get it, your grandchildren can't get it, and it's going to maybe run a theater or whatever you want to do, and it's there forever. Where we drew the line, though, was on real estate. And the reason we did that is you look around the state of Wyoming and look at the amount of private property we have, and if we allow these folks to put these this real estate into these trusts, in theory, we could be here 200, 300 years from now, and all the real estate is all bound up in these trusts. You can't develop it. You can't move it. You can't even get to it. At least if it's in a corporation, you can go buy the stock up, and you can then sell the ranch. But it would not be good for Wyoming to allow wealthy people to acquire vast amounts of property, put them in trust, and be held there forever, that nobody could ever get to it. So we made the exception. Now, you wouldn't like it if, for example, there's a piece of property right in the middle of town that the town needs to grow, and they put it into a trust in perpetuity, and the community can never be built or grown. You can't get the property out. In 25 years, 1,000 years, you'll never get the opportunity to improve it, to utilize it, to grow your community. So we apply it to real estate. My question here is, what are we doing with respect to minerals? Are we going to allow someone who says, look, I'm going to acquire all the minerals in over some of the most valuable gas deposits in Wyoming, and now I'm going to take those mineral interests and I'm going to put them in a trust that says they can never be developed. They're there forever, and this trust now, the rule of perpetuity doesn't apply. So even though it might be in the best interest of Wyoming or the next generation and the next generation and the next generation to have those minerals developed, We've allowed, we've said the rule of perpetuities doesn't apply. You don't get to wait 21 years and get it. That's effectively a way just to take it. You know, with conservation easements, incidentally, we have provisions that if the needs of the state change, you can break the conservation easement. There are ways to do that, and that's the reason why we wanted that statute, is to have mechanisms to say, look, this conservation easement now has created a problem that's against the public interest, and we need, if for example, it's that land in the middle and it needs to be developed for some reason, there's a mechanism to break that trust. I understand putting royalty interest into it because then somebody else is controlling the mineral interest. There's a person that can develop it, it goes there. To put a royalty interest into it, fair enough, because it's already been divided. But to take a mineral interest and put it into and say that's no longer bound or covered by the rule of perpetuities, imagine what can happen. So I guess the discussion, and I'm not even sure it may be that the old law is this way, but we need, if the old law was that way, it's time to take a look at it. Are we going to allow you imagine I want to put my mineral interest so they will be developed. But now take a step back. Suppose somebody has the resources to acquire the mineral interest, puts them in a trust forever, and the terms of the trust are that those minerals can never be developed. Are we as a state going to say that's okay?
Senator Perkins.
And just so you know what this bill does, let's go and talk about where the law is right now. What is law today without this bill? The law today is that you can take mineral interests and you can put them in trusts for up to 1,000 years. That's what the law is right now. What this bill does is, under the current law, you have to come back and you have to say some magic words. And you find those magic words in 34.139B. And so, which sets forth, it just says, if you put these magic words in your trust, then you can have personal property and mineral interest tied up to 1,000 years. That's where the law is today. What this comes back and says is, you can just make a trust, and you can put your personal property in it, and you can put your mineral interest into it, but you don't have to say the magic words. You can just make the trust. So what it is it makes it a little bit easier. It makes it so it's for the common man to be able to, he doesn't have to have any magic words, he can just do that. But it doesn't change the ability that if you have the right lawyer or you have the right accountant, that you can get the magic words in your trust and tie up that real estate. Well, the real estate is all, and just so you know, the real estate is always subject to the rule against perpetuities, even in this bill. And that is that the real estate is not exempted. If you look specifically on page 3, you look at that new language starting on lines 15. If a trust owns or holds both interests in property and real property other than real property, subsection A shall apply to real property interests. Subsection A is the rule against perpetuities. So that doesn't change. Real property is still subject to the rule against perpetuities. We're only talking about personal property and now mineral interests. Under the current law, they're already able to be put in trust up to 1,000 years. And if that's the wrong time, then we need to bring a bill to undo that. But what this bill simply says is that you don't have to do the magic words abracadabra. You have to put in it, and just what you do is you have to pull it out of the statute. And if you list those words, then you can do it. This statute says you don't have to list the magic words; you can do it. Unless you decide something else, you can have that. You can make that mineral interest and personal property in there for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. You can have the rule against perpetuities apply if you want it to, or you can have it go up to 1,000 years if you want to as well. So that part of the rule, this bill doesn't address the concerns that the good senator from Albany County have, which are valid concerns. But those are policy decisions that are actually kind of beyond the scope of this bill. You can, if you vote this bill down, you can still do exactly what he's concerned that you shouldn't be able to do.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think I share the concerns of the senator from Albany County and wonder if maybe we don't need to do something here. Because it looks to me, and please somebody correct me if I'm wrong, if you want to lock up a piece of real property, you put it in a corporation. Then you put the shares of the corporation in the trust, and you've gone right around the intent of the law we've got, and you've locked up a piece of real property for a very long period of time. And it doesn't, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't bother me that you lock up the income that comes off that property and say how it's going to be distributed. That doesn't have some of the bad consequences. But if you can say this piece of property, you know, Section 20, township thus and such, range thus and such, shall not be developed, and you can say that right now, and it's good for 1,000 years. That's what the rule of perpetuities, that's the evil the rule of perpetuities is seeking to prevent. And it looks to me like with this bill and the previous one, we've laid ourselves open to that. And I'm wondering if it's possible to amend this bill to put a stop to that, or how we ought to handle that, because I'm concerned we're getting ourselves into a trouble we ought not to get into. That, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me a good part of the rule against perpetuities is so that you have real living people who can make sensible decisions on what to do with some of those assets and aren't bound by what somebody thought they ought to do 50 or 100 years ago.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With these bills, we do need to really watch them carefully. I mean, folks, I have a lot of clients that come in, and the natural tendency is to say, you know, I've spent my life putting this ranch together, and I want to make sure that it's there 1,000 years from now, just the way I see it. And it is the tendency of people that have amassed wealth to want to concentrate it and rule it from their death. And we found out many years ago it simply wasn't a good policy. And, you know, the flip side of it is if you drive down the road and there's a beautiful ranch, you ought to be able to buy it if you got enough money and the person wants to sell it. But some of these things are designed to prevent that from ever happening. There won't be land to develop. There won't be places. You won't have the chance to have your children to have ranches. And what is happening, of course, is that there is also, so there's great pressure on folks that have developed wealth to try to rule it from their death. And there's even greater pressure for banks who can be the trust officers and receive the income off of the trust to change the laws to amass these trusts. And you've heard of those big trusts in New York, and that's there are companies in there, and all they do is run these trusts, take off 10, 15, 20% of the interest every year, and they're collecting it, and the properties are sitting there unavailable for anybody in the world. It's not a good policy. And what we're seeing is that the desire to do that and the desire of the trust companies to increase their trust departments is in conflict with what we want. I think that we should want as a state, and that is to make sure land is available to be purchased, it goes from generation to generation, and that we don't lock it up like our federal lands or worse. So the issue here is, I think the inquiry is exactly right. What's the need for it? And I suspect if you find out the answer to that, you'll find out there are people that want to tie up this property and control it from their death. And is that a good policy? So now if you're... you know, why should you be able to tie up land for more than 21 years after somebody that's living? You take your youngest grandchild, say that plus 21 years, that's what you get, no longer. But so I guess I am interested in, and if that's not the evil, if that's not the intention of these, is to create more trust for more banks to run and for families to rule from their death, for real estate, then I think we ought to reject the idea. And I concur. You put it into a corporation, and now you put the stock into it. You've just done an end run against that which we were trying to prevent.
Senator Perkins.
Those are all valid policy considerations, and I'm not going to argue necessarily for or against those. I just want to point out the body's already made this decision. You guys decided this before I ever got here. The law, I mean, if you go to the existing statute, forget this bill, throw it over there for now, and let's just talk about what the law is for now. The law right now says, in 34.139, which was here before I came here, says real property for the purposes of subsection B. Subsection B is the place where if you make the magic invocation of the statutory words, you can put it in trust for you can put it in trust. But keep in mind that even here, you guys our progenitors before us, those are our predecessors in the Senate, said or allowed that real property can't be in these trusts for 1,000 years. But our predecessors also said in subsection D that mineral interests aren't going to be considered real property for the purposes of this rule against perpetuities. That's already been done. This was decided 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, I don't know. And it also said that not only does it not include mineral interests, but our predecessors also said that it doesn't include an interest in a corporation, limited liability company, partnership, business trust, or other entity. So this bill doesn't add to or delete from that. It simply says you don't have to do the magic invocation. Now, if the policy is, well, we want you to, before you can do this unholy thing, before you can do this unholy act, you have to say the magic words in the statute, then we vote this bill down. But if you want, because the policy, if the policy doesn't do it, we need to come back, and you can throw this bill out, but you need to come back and you need to repeal substantive provisions of 34.139. Because that's how you come back and combat the policy that we're talking about right now. This bill furthers it to the degree in that you don't have to say the magic words. They're going to be presumed. It still doesn't affect real property itself, but you can tie up, as we've talked about, mineral interests and these corporate interests, limited liability company interests. The law doesn't change there. You can tie it up under the existing law. You can tie it up under here. If you stop this, you won't stop the evil you're talking about unless somebody's dumb enough not to say the magic words.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I would urge us to pass this bill through committee of the whole. I think maybe with a second reading amendment, we could come back and provide that maybe you can tie up where the revenue is going, but that you can't tie up the management of that, and that has to go to real people with discretion as to how to manage it. And I think given the title, that's something we could do in this, and I think we ought to. So I would urge us to pass it through committee of the whole.
Question.
Senator Jennings.
Question.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the committee of the whole rise, report that I do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 158, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
House Bill 158 has passed committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 159. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 159, Uniform Trust Code Amendments, and Act Relating to the Uniform Trust Code, sponsored by Representative Brown. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Reading the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Perkins? I'm sorry, it's not. Now it is.
Now it is? Do I have to start over? Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 159. What this one is the last, I promise, is the last of the estate planning bills that come before you today. And I don't know aware of any others, Mr. Chairman, that have come in this session. What this one is I think there's, quite frankly, I think there's some buyer's remorse on, actually not buyer's remorse. Several years ago, we made some substantial revisions regarding the Uniform Trust Code. In there, and what this bill does, it comes in and tries to clarify a couple of issues. The first one is on page 2. You have 2 point under subparagraph A, which is lines 5 through 6. You're talking about a power of appointment. A power of appointment means that you don't necessarily own the property, but you have the right to appoint it or to transfer it or to designate it to go to somebody else. And so when you have that power of appointment, the question is, if you have that power, when can your creditors get at that power and make you appoint it to them or take it over and do something different with it? And so this comes in and clarifies that if you've got that power, then it can only be attached by the creditors or signees of the person holding that power. If it's authorized, if they're authorized to appoint their property to themselves, their creditors or their estate, or the creditors of their estate, and, so it's a two-pronged test, the other one would be you actually exercise that power of appointment in favor of yourself, your creditors, the creditors of your estate. If you do that, then the creditors can't attach that. If you don't do that, if you don't do both, meet both those requirements, your creditors can't get at it. In B, the difference between A and B is, and there you're talking about the power holder has a power to withdraw. That's not a right to appoint, but that's a power to actually take something out of the trust for yourself. And this makes it consistent throughout the other provisions in the Uniform Trust Code that the creditors can get at that when you pull it out, not until you pull it out, but when you actually exercise the pull it out, then the creditors can jump on it and attach it at that point. And that's consistent with other places in the bill. The other thing this does on page 3, as you see these spendthrift provisions, it makes it, when it was passed before, there's a language in 410.501. This makes it consistent with that. Again, this is talking about when the trust provides that the trustee can only make discretionary distributions to the beneficiary. That means that it's the trustee decides when and if it's in the best interest of the beneficiary to get it. The trustee will then make the distribution. Not until the trustee actually makes the distribution can the creditors get at it. Creditors can't get at the trust. There's a couple of exceptions to that, mostly due to child support. But other than that, creditors can't get at it until it's actually distributed out to the beneficiary. And the other changes on page 4 are the trustee makes distributions directly to third parties. So again, if it comes out of the trust and they've made it to the beneficiary to the benefit of third party, then the creditors can jump on it. The creditors of the beneficiary can jump on it. And the last couple changes there, and you see in 410.506 is on page 4. They're trying to make this consistent with the Internal Revenue Code. So when you see that under certain if there's claims against the settlor, when and if it's included in the settlor or which is the trust makers, the owner of the trust, whether it's included in their estate or not. And the last one is, you see on page 5, is the settlor's receipt each year of income or principal from a grantor retained annuity trust or a grantor retained unit trust is allowed under, that's just a cleanup on this that the, that in when you have a qualified spendthrift trust, which is what we did, I think, 3 years ago, we created these qualified spendthrift trusts, that under those situations that it's irrevocable, it's not deemed irrevocable on the count that this comes back. And it's mostly an IRS issue, determining about whether or not the spendthrift trust is going to be taxable in your estate or not. And N provides that under those circumstances, it's not going to be in your state if you set up those trust rights. That's what the bill does. If you want further explanation or have questions, we can go into it. But, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
There is an amendment on the bill. Standing Committee number 1. I'll have the reading clerk read the bill. Read the amendment.
Is there an amendment? I didn't think there was an amendment.
House Bill 159, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 4, line 2.
Are there any discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 159?
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 59. All this did is go back in and try and, since we're talking about trust, we tried to do the King's English correctly, or the Queen's English correctly. On page 4, line 2, we just changed the word from direct to directly, which I think was just was recommended to us as just a grammatical change. So we're on the amendment. Ask for your favorable consideration of the amendment. And if there's no questions on that amendment, we'll call for the question on the amendment.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill Number 159, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. We are back on the bill.
Question on the bill.
All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 159, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
House Bill 159 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 160. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 160, Management Audit Committee Subpoena Power and Act Relating to Legislative Oversight, sponsored by the Management Audit Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. The report's back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dock, Statter, Driscoll, and Escobel. Senator Burns, Chairman.
The reading clerk has read the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 160. There are no standing committee amendments, and to further explain the bill, I think, is me. Mr. Chairman, all the standing committees currently, and I think most of the select committees in the legislature currently have subpoena power to get documents that we need. It turns out that the Management Audit Committee doesn't have that authority, and if there's any committee that needs it, I think the Management Audit Committee is probably that entity. The reason that the reason that we found out that it didn't was there was an issue on one of the agencies that Management Audit was studying in this past interim. And there came up some issues about privacy, and one of the federal agencies was very hesitant to give us the documentation that we needed in order to properly audit that particular agency. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill, clean and simple.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 160, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. That bill has passed Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration. Chairman recognizes Majority Floor Leader Lot Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Already? Yeah, it's still light out.
Yeah, I didn't realize that we're going to have some.
Do you call for the motion?
Reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 5, do pass amended. House Bill 13, do pass amended. House Bill 28, do pass. House Bill 37, do pass amended. House Bill 63, do pass amended. House Bill 69 do pass. House Bill 74 do pass. House Bill 110 do pass amended. House Bill 111 do pass amended. House Bill 143 do pass amended. House Bill 153 do pass amended. House Bill 157 do pass. House Bill 158 do pass. House Bill 159 do pass amended. And House Bill 160 do pass. Senator Barnard,
Chairman.
Senator Barnard.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. That motion is carried, and the report has been adopted. Signing of enrolled acts. Senate Enrolled Act 35.
Senate Enrolled Act 35 being original Senate File 81.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 35, original Senate File 81. Have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 36.
Senate Enrolled Act 36 being original Senate File 103.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 36, original Senate File 103. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act number 37.
Senate Enrolled Act number 37 being original Senate File 94.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act number 37, original Senate File 94. Has so signed. Senate Enrolled Act number 23.
It's a house. House Enrolled Act number 23 being original House Bill 9.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 23, original House Bill 9. So signed. House Enrolled Act number 24.
House Enrolled Act number 24 being original House Bill 62.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 24, original House Bill 62. Has so signed. House Enrolled Act number 25.
House Enrolled Act number 25 being original House Bill 95.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 25, original House Bill 95. House Enrolled Act 26.
House Enrolled Act number 26 being original House Bill 105.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 26, original House Bill 105. Have so signed.
Just barely had one up here.
Is that it? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning, February 17th.
Announcements? Senator Geis.
We're going to have a conference committee meeting tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock in S-15. On House Bill 18, Quarantine of Animals. And then upon adjournment tomorrow night, we're going to have a committee meeting, and we're going to take up House Bill 163, Engrossed Water Produced from Geologic Sequences. And we'll take up House Bill 251, Engrossed Abortion Ultrasound Information.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your conference committee on House Bill 109 and House Bill 113 will meet tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. up in S-18 to discuss those two bills.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Corporations Committee number 7 will meet tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Note the time change, or it's the early time. It's earlier than our usual time, in room S-19 to hear and continue discussion on House Bill 137, engrossed, private transfer fee obligations, House Bill 224, engrossed, platted plots requirement, House Bill 178, engrossed, vaults, crypts, and mausoleums, perpetual trust funds, House Bill 179, energy improvement program, and House Bill 242, engrossed insurance surplus lines. And also, Mr. President, the previously announced conference committee that was going to be held upon adjournment with respect to the bill, I don't remember the number, but it was mail ballot elections, has been canceled for tonight because nobody's, the House is gone.
Okay, Senator Schiffer and then Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, your Transportation Committee is going to meet in 10 minutes, which would be 20 after 5 on the official clock, to upstairs in S-14 to take up House Bill 235, engrossed, natural gas vehicles, House Bill 208, off-road vehicle registration exemption, and House Bill 90, engrossed, vehicle restoration.
Thank you. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. The euphoria of going through this plethora of bills, I think that we have some re-referrals in the appropriation, and we didn't give notice. With those, we're not required to give a day earlier notice. We can go right in for the re-referrals. So if you have a bill that's with us, I know we've got at least one. We'll probably hear it tomorrow on an adjournment, and I'll give notification tomorrow to make sure that the sponsors are aware. But we will start meeting again tomorrow on adjournment.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, your Rules Committee number 12 will meet tomorrow at 1 o'clock in S-5 to consider House Bill 87, Obsolete Laws, General Revisions.
Are there other announcements? You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion was that we be adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning, February 17th. We are adjourned.